to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Well, this has been a pretty full week for news. It hasn't been the best of weeks. In fact, some of the news has been pretty horrendous and brings up more questions than we have answers to. Welcome to Weekly Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Well, I guess the first thing, the biggest story this week, were the two mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. They were shocking. Let's begin in El Paso, at the Walmart. Walmart is more than just a store. Walmart is a place where many people go on Saturday to shop, grab some coffee, to buy food, their groceries, clothes for the kids, toys for the kids, electronics, whatever you need for the house. It's all there at Walmart. So it becomes an excursion. It's an outing. And in El Paso, Texas, last Saturday, there were over 3,000 people in the store. Imagine. And at 2 p.m., a man with a long gun stood in the parking lot and began shooting. By the time he was captured, he had killed 20 people and wounded 26 more. And not to mention the thousands of people that he terrified. Early reports said that he had produced a manifesto which appeared online about 20 minutes before he began shooting. And the manifesto was a screed against what he called the invasion of Mexicans into the United States. He believed, according to his manifesto, that this invasion would destroy America as we know it, and his role, as he saw it, was to launch the first attack against this possibility. The manifesto was very articulate and completely insane. So here we are in the face of such a horrific event. The stories that are coming out of El Paso are heartbreaking. A man dropped his 87-year-old mother off at the entrance to Walmart and then went to park the car. How many of us have done that? We do it all the time. But as he was driving away, he heard gunshots, and he ran back to find his mother inside Walmart, on the floor, dead. The shock of something like that in the middle of doing something so absolutely normal is simply breathtaking. And then there was the young mother who was holding her baby and fell with her baby in her arms and covered the baby with her own body in order to protect it. She died, but the baby survived, although with several broken bones. These stories, they tear at the heart, and they're so unnecessary, because going to Walmart on a Saturday afternoon is one of the most normal things that Americans do. And to have this disrupted by a wild-eyed maniac, a man with an agenda so evil that it doesn't come under anything less than domestic terrorism. And we remain, and the people of El Paso remain, brokenhearted. And then you have the event in Ohio. This was another madness. A man shows up with 100 rounds of ammunition and a long gun and starts shooting. It happened at 1 o'clock in the morning, behind a bar in a very popular area of Dayton, Ohio. And this is really quite a remarkable story, because the villain in this story had what was described as an AK-47 type automatic rifle. Now, they say he purchased it legally, but I don't understand how that is possible, because this gun was firing automatically, not on a semi-automatic setting, which is legal. And it also had a barrel magazine which was capable of holding 100 rounds. That means he could do an awful lot of damage in almost no time at all, which is exactly what he did. And when he began firing, the police immediately attacked him. It was over in a flash. 30 seconds, imagine. Within 30 seconds, he had been taken down by the local police, who killed him. But in that 30 seconds, he managed to murder 9 people, including his own sister, and wound 27 others. What's going on in this country? And what kind of conversations are we about to have? Well, the usual knee-jerk reaction to any event like this is an urgent and emotional cry for gun control. Now, some forms of gun control, I think, are probably useful. Things like background checks and maybe banning certain types of military equipment. Maybe. I don't even want to go there, because the point I want to make is that we have gun controls in various parts of the country. We have gun control in Massachusetts, where many kinds of frequently used guns in other parts of the country are banned. We have gun control in Chicago, which is one of the murder capitals of the country. Very strict gun control in Chicago. And we have gun control in California, where the laws are also very strict and getting stricter. But you know, the funny thing is that it doesn't seem to stop crimes that are committed with guns. And why is that? Well, the realistic answer is that the bad guys don't follow the laws. They're not going to obey the gun control laws. And they don't buy their guns in stores or at gun shows. They buy them on the street. They buy them from illegal gun dealers. So we have an imbalance here. We have people, very emotional people, agitating, demonstrating for gun control, strict gun control, ban assault weapons, whatever they are. We don't know what they are because they're never defined. Ban weapons that, you know, look scary. Some people say, ban weapons that are like AR-15s. Well, AR-15 is just another form of a semi-automatic rifle, which is not that unusual as a hunting weapon. And then there are people who want certain people not to have guns. Now, I have a friend in California who once asked me if I had a gun. He wanted to know, he wanted really to tell me that he had a gun. And he told me what kind. It was a Colt 45, something we call a 1911. And I asked him, I said, tell me, how do you feel about gun control? He says, oh, I'm for it. I said, really? But you have a gun. What about your neighbors? He says, well, I want to have a gun, but I don't want them to have one. Well, that's pretty hypocritical, isn't it? Why are you better than your neighbors? Why is your need to protect yourself more important than theirs? And maybe they need to protect themselves from you. Who knows? So we are back to a discussion that's going to come any day now, and maybe it's already here. But the point is that this is a knee-jerk reaction. It's going to happen. And there's more to the story than just gun control, because we see in various parts of the country that it doesn't work. Do you remember the Mandalay Bay shooting in October 2017? How do we stop these mass shootings that are so insane? In that one event, 58 people were murdered, and another 422 people were wounded by the gunfire. And in the ensuing panic, another 850 people were injured. That was probably the most massive mass shooting in America. It was someone in a high window of the Mandalay Bay Hotel firing down on a crowd of concert goers. It's horrendous. What kind of sickness infects the minds of people who do this sort of thing? Now, there's another backstory to the Mandalay Bay, but I'm not going to go into that now. We'll probably cover that on another day. But from the point of view of guns and people having them and using them inappropriately, our country's in a lot of danger, and our population, the American people, are at high risk, not from terrorism, which is to say, not from jihadist terrorism, but from what they call domestic terrorism. So the anti-gun lobby wants to ban all automatic weapons, anything that looks like what they call an assault rifle, anything black and scary looking, and they want to hold the gun manufacturers liable for any events like this. And they want very, very strict gun purchase laws. In fact, they would like to confiscate guns completely. But this is America, guys, and I don't think we're ready to do that. I don't think Congress would pass such a bill, and I don't think the American people would stand for it. One of the Democratic candidates made the point that there are more guns in America than people. And that may be true, I don't know. But Americans like to hunt. And they like to protect themselves, which is what the Second Amendment is all about, that Americans have the right to keep and bear arms in order to protect ourselves from a central government gone mad that wants to take our rights away. Does any of this sound familiar? We live in a country where there is a very large movement against gun ownership. They want guns off the street. They want guns off out of our homes. They want guns in the hands of law enforcement, the military only. But here's the problem. There's an old saying among gun owners that when there are only seconds to act, calling 911 will bring you help in minutes. And that's not good enough. So there is another very large group of people, Americans, who believe that they have the right and the obligation to protect themselves and their families in their homes by owning a gun and being able to use it to protect their families. And I don't disagree with that. So how do you find a happy medium somewhere, a compromise between these two positions? Well, let me talk about the society for a minute that we're living in. It's a society where Antifa goes on the street with masks, threatens people they don't agree with, in some cases beats them up, and they get a pass in cities like Portland, Seattle. Why is that? Why are we condoning, even embracing, freedom to commit violence against people you don't agree with? Isn't that part of where this gun violence comes from? Doesn't one thing lead to another? You know, I had a friend about 15 years ago in another part of the country who was a director of a children's club. This is where kids came after school for after-school activities and kept them safe and out of harm's way. And he believed that the video games that children play, the violent video games, that these games were contributing to a mindset that desensitized them to violence. You know, in the beginning, these video games, well, in the way in the beginning, we did Space Invaders with geometric shapes, and we killed the aliens as they came down from the skies, and we were blasting squares and triangles. But later on, as the graphics industry became more sophisticated, we started killing monsters. They were still cartoon figures. And when you hit them, they blew up and you saw splashes of red, which was supposed to stand for blood. But they were still cartoons. I mean, we all grew up with cartoons that were violent, very violent, some of them. Remember Tom and Jerry, the cat and the mouse? Remember Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote? He used to drop Wile E. Coyote off cliffs. That was violent, but somehow it wasn't the same thing, because as the graphics industry became more and more sophisticated, we started killing animations of characters who looked like people, and when you hit them, they bled, and it looked real. And the more sophisticated the industry became, the more realistic the people that we were killing in this video game became. And I agree with my friend that we are desensitizing our children to violence because the games are becoming more and more lifelike. I'm not sure where we go with this, because if we're talking about putting restrictions on video games, on video graphics, then we're talking about a kind of censorship. And we have to understand what the real connection is between the video games and the mass shootings. And I think this is going to take a lot of work. Our congressmen aren't good at that. They don't like to work. They like to have a microphone in their face and they'll tell you what they think, whether they know anything about it or not. But they don't want to do the heavy lifting. And in this case, there's a lot of heavy lifting, because we need to do a real psychological profile on the effect of violent, graphic, realistic video games on the tendencies to violence in our children. And that's a big ask, but it's also a necessary one. I don't believe gun control is going to do very much. It hasn't done anything in Chicago, hasn't done much in Los Angeles. I think the more important thing is, how are we going to address the underlying issues that lead to this violence? And it may mean not only doing a psychological study of the impact of violent videos on children's psyches, but we may have to also go back and look at some of these horrific mass shootings that have taken place in schools and in places of work. What is driving these people? And we need to take it seriously, and we need to do it now. Well, we're going to take a short break, and you can hear from the good people at America Out Loud. And then I'll be right back. We have other topics to talk about, but I'm going to continue with this just a bit. And then we're going to move on to see what else is going on in the world.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
So we come back to the horror of the last weekend, and I want to talk about something that is more uplifting. Now, again, we're going to get into politics, but I want to lead the conversation away from politics, at least for the time being. It's hard to avoid politics these days, but this is something bigger than just politics as usual. On the Monday following the mass murders in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, the president made an address to the country. It wasn't a political speech. It wasn't an off-the-cuff speech that the president is used to giving. It was a carefully crafted address to the American people to try to bring us all together, to create a pathway for working together to solve the terrible, terrible problem of violence in America. He did it very well. It was an emotional speech for him, I think. My feeling was that he was very, very moved, and it was difficult. But here is what he said. He addressed the shock and horror and sorrow that we were all feeling. He said, "We are a loving nation, and our children are entitled to grow up in a peaceful and loving environment." And he vowed to act with urgent resolve to bring the country together so that we could, in one voice, condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy in America. He said hate has no place in America, and that it is absolutely essential and urgent to investigate and disrupt hate crimes, and domestic terror wherever it is found. And then he pointed out some interesting things, things that really haven't been addressed in the demands for immediate gun control and gun confiscation and all the other things that the radical left is demanding. He said that the internet has provided a dangerous avenue to radicalize disturbed minds. And he is right. The internet is wild with opportunity for people who are disturbed and potentially violent to act out their aggressions. You get on the internet and you can say anything you want with almost no interference by the providers who offer you the opportunity. But his aim, he said, by addressing the internet, is to stop mass murders before they start. He said the perils of the internet cannot be ignored, and neither can the perils of social media. And he said we need to act as one people in a real bipartisan effort to address these issues. He came up with a four-part plan that I think is worth considering. First, he wanted to identify and act on the early warning signs, using the social media companies to develop tools to detect potential shooters before the individuals ever engage in violent behavior, which is to say, shooting. And he asked for the cooperation of federal, state, and local agencies to do this. Then he wanted to stop the glorification of violence in our society. And my gosh, it is glorified. All you have to do is turn on the television, any one of many, many shows. They go as law enforcement agency shows, or they turn up as military shows, or they turn up as all kinds of so-called popular entertainment. But they're violent, and they're grisly, and they're gruesome, and they need to be reeled in. Some of them are very popular, even with most of us. I'm not going to name names because I think that's counterproductive. But most of you know the kinds of shows I'm talking about. It's too easy, the president said, for troubled youth to surround themselves with a culture that celebrates violence. So we have to stop or substantially reduce this, and we need to do it now. He also mentioned video games. And the video games we've already talked about, but we need to talk about them some more. Not now, not here, but we need to address this. This is a very, very serious problem when you have a control that is shooting what looks like real people and killing them and committing violence against them. It seems to me that it is unlikely that susceptible people are not going to mix the fantasy and the reality and act out some of the things that they see and they interact with the video games. Then, number three, we must reform our mental health laws so that we can identify the mentally disturbed individuals who may commit the acts of violence. Now, that's a good idea. He recommended not only treatment for them, but if necessary, involuntary confinement. He said, and I quote, "Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the guns." And of course, that's right. A gun is just an inanimate object. It takes a person to put their finger inside the trigger guard and pull that trigger. And then number four, ensure that those who are judged to pose a grave risk to public safety, that they do not have access to firearms, and that if they do, that those firearms can legally be taken away from them through a rapid due process. He is suggesting legislation that ensures that those convicted of mass murders face the death penalty and that this capital punishment will be carried out quickly and without years of delay, which is the process now, and we've all seen it play out. These are very, very strong suggestions, recommendations from the president. He closed his address by saying that it is time to set destructive partisanship aside and find the courage to answer hatred with unity, devotion, and love. And then he ended with something very, very important. He said, "Our future is in our control. We can rise up to the challenge. The choice is ours and ours alone. It's not up to the mentally ill monsters to pave the way, to create the disasters such as we have seen this weekend, to disrupt our lives, some of them forever, and create the chaos that America, unfortunately, is today." I just want to second the president's remarks. I agree with them. We have to come together. I've talked a lot on this program, and I've written a lot on the website, the America Out Loud website, about the disruption of our society by the hatred and the goading and the dysfunction of our government because we cannot agree to compromise. It has to end. Our country is in grave danger from this disruption, and we need to put an end to it by putting aside our animus and coming together at the same table with the same agenda to compromise, to make peace between us, and to start getting things done. And I can't think of a more important job than to start the process of putting an end to this rampant and unchecked violence in our country. All right, I'm going to move this conversation now to Hong Kong. We've talked about Hong Kong before. Hong Kong is in turmoil. You know, the history of Hong Kong is so interesting. It was originally part of China, and then way, way back, when China and Britain were making some sort of peace between them, China ceded the peninsula of Hong Kong to the British. And the British took over, and they made a free market economy in a place that was attached at the hip to what became communist China. And Hong Kong thrived. Oh, Hong Kong was amazing. If you had never been to Hong Kong, it's a city of lights. It's a city of wonder. It's this tiny piece of land where there is so much going on. But then something happened because China wanted Hong Kong back. Communist China wanted free market Hong Kong back. And eventually, Britain came to the table and agreed to give Hong Kong back to China. But they wanted Hong Kong to continue to have a free market economy for another 50 years. And they wanted Hong Kong to also have autonomy for 50 years. China reluctantly agreed with some qualifications. So in 1997, Britain ceded Hong Kong back to China, to communist China, under those conditions. And Hong Kong remained free enterprise, free market economy, and it still thrived. Even though many Chinese living in Hong Kong left the country, moved to Canada, to Vancouver, where the joke was that the first language in Vancouver, Canada, was not English, it was Cantonese. It did not take long for China to start backing off its commitment to Great Britain. China started encroaching on the autonomy of Hong Kong. It took away Hong Kong's right to elect its own officials, its own government. And it appointed a government. And the appointed government began to enact laws that would, to a greater or lesser extent, limit the autonomy of Hong Kong. A couple of months ago, the government introduced a law that would enable China to extradite citizens of Hong Kong to China for judgment in certain kinds of criminal or economic offenses. This was too much for the people of Hong Kong, and they began to demonstrate. The demonstrations were peaceful, but they grew exponentially. On one notable Sunday, 1 million people came out into the streets of Hong Kong to demonstrate against this law that they found totally unacceptable. The reason was clear. In Hong Kong, there was a reasonable process for justice. But the people of Hong Kong knew that if Hong Kong citizens went to China, they no longer had control over the process of what the Chinese called justice and the people in Hong Kong called injustice. So they began to demonstrate. And the demonstrations got larger, and the Chinese police presence became stronger. And instead of just monitoring the demonstrations, they began to use tear gas and other forms of crowd control in order to keep the demonstrations in check. And there began to be a worry that China may at some point decide that enough is enough. And if you remember what happened in Tiananmen Square, the fear of a Tiananmen Square in Hong Kong in 2019 was becoming more and more real. They still weren't violent demonstrations until the police started using tear gas and batons and other ways of crowd control that made these nonviolent protesters start fighting back. Now, this past Sunday, the demonstrations got very serious and they changed. The plan for the demonstration was to meet in a certain place, and the police were ready to meet them there, in force. So the demonstrators decided on a new tactic. Instead of coming in force to the place that they had publicized, they made their demonstrations in a flash mob way. They would gather in a place, make their demonstration, and as soon as the police showed up, they would scatter. They would all disappear. And they'd go to another place where they would have another demonstration until the police showed up. And then they would scatter again. It ended up in a more violent confrontation than anybody wanted, I suppose. But there was still no Tiananmen Square. There seems to be something more going on than just an extension of the original demonstrations. These kinds of demonstrations don't stand still. They take on a life of their own. And I believe that's happening here. It seems to me that the people of Hong Kong have decided that they do not want to go back to China in 2047. They want freedom. They want independence. And I believe that's where these demonstrations are going. And I also believe that China will not put up with it. So we are heading for a confrontation. And that confrontation is going to have ramifications around the world. Now, the reason I mention this is because of a totally different issue, which we haven't talked about before. Over the weekend, it became clear that the trade talks had stalled, that China was upping the ante by devaluing their own currency. They were responding to the president's threat to impose new tariffs on Chinese exports in September. On Monday, the stock markets all reacted dramatically to what is going on between the United States and China. What happened to the stock market? It tumbled dramatically. By midday, the Dow Jones had dropped more than 800 points. And by the end of the trading day, the Dow Jones settled down 767 points. Stocks were tumbling. And the value of portfolios was tumbling as well. So what does this have to do with Hong Kong? China's in a bind. China devalued its currency, and that's going to hurt the Chinese people because the cost of everything is going to go up. And the effect of the demonstrations in Hong Kong are having an impact on China. China's in a big bind right now. What's going to happen in Hong Kong? What's going to happen to the trade talks? What's going to happen to their own currency? What's going to happen to their own economy, which is lower than it has been in 30 years? So China has become a big question mark, and it's hurting everybody involved. Now, the other day I was wondering, with the American economy as good as it is, or as good as it was last week, But the European economy, not very good. The Chinese economy, not very good. How are we going to continue to be good? And it turns out, well, this is all affecting everything that our country is doing international. I don't have any answers for you right now. I'm raising the question. How does what's happening in Hong Kong affect China? What is China going to do in Hong Kong? And how will that affect our talks with China? How will that affect our own economy? Will Hong Kong remain a free market economy, or is China going to take over? In the words of the demonstrators, heaven will destroy the Communist Party. Liberate Hong Kong. This does not sound like the people of Hong Kong are ready to give up anytime soon. The people of Hong Kong have had a taste of freedom, and they like it. Well, we're going to take another short break, but don't go away because we've got something very interesting for the next part of the show.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good-tasting gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company, Healthy Cell, will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com. Spreading the outloud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
You know, we talked before about the dysfunction of our government. And honestly, I talk about this all the time. I find it very, very distressing. The only one who seems to be making any progress at all is the president. And he's doing it independently, unilaterally, because he has no choice. Congress is totally unable to function. They are so busy fighting him, fighting each other, both Democrat versus Republican and Democrat versus Democrat, that nothing, virtually nothing, is getting done. And this is a situation that really has to stop. A government cannot function without its legislative body also functioning. Now Congress is away on a 6-week vacation. Who gets a 6-week vacation? Well, Congress does, even though they don't do anything when they are in session. They are simply non-functional. So what do? They take junkets. Junkets are trips that you pay for. I pay for them. It's ridiculous. They do this at the taxpayer's expense. Just this past week, Nancy Pelosi and Ilhan Omar just came back from Africa. What is it going to take to make our legislative body, our Congress, our House of Representatives and our Senate, to get back to work, to do the work that we pay them to do? And by the way, their salaries are not small. Did you know that a starting salary for a new freshman congressperson or senator is $174,000 a year? I wish I had the salary that they have. Maybe I should run for office. Well, maybe not. I did run for office once. I ran for Congress once. And someone said to me, why do you want to get into that cesspool? It was a good question then, and it's still a good question. I have no idea. I certainly do not want to spend the next 2 or 6 years of my life in Washington. No, thank you. But anyway, on a more serious note, what do we have to do to make our Congress more functional? How do we get them to do their job? Well, I think part of the problem is that we're electing the wrong people, and we keep electing them over and over again. We're electing the old-timers who go back and they sit in Congress for another 2 or 6 years, and then they come back and look for re-election again. Really? I don't think so. They're not. How have they earned their keep? How have they earned the right to go back to Congress and do nothing? We need fresh blood, not the kind of fresh blood that is represented by Ocasio-Cortez and Tlaib and Omar and Presley. They came to Congress to disrupt it, to destroy the process, to make it less functional. No, that's not the kind of fresh blood I'm talking about, but the kind of fresh blood that actually comes and is eager to do something, not tear it apart. It's a good question. And you know what? I'd be interested in what you think. I'm not going to give any answers today. This is just tossing out the question. What do we have to do to get Congress to go back to work and start doing their job, start passing legislation, start crafting legislation that is meaningful and will work, and then passing the legislation and letting it go to work? That's their job. Let's see them do it. So what do you think is necessary? What do we have to do to get them back to work, doing their job? And stop fighting with each other. Part of this picture, you know, is not just that they're not doing their job, but they're wasting our tax dollars by continually quibbling with each other, trying to undermine the president, trying to sabotage the president, and honestly making a laughing stock of our government. The only one who's doing any work at all that we can tell is the president himself. And he's the one they're trying to destroy. Amazing. So, I'd like to know what you think. Send me an email at Ilana, that's I-L-A-N-A, Ilana, at AmericaOutloud.com, and let me hear from you. Let me know what you think. How do we do this? Okay. You know, we've had two subjects today that are incredibly and regrettably linked. The shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, and the dysfunction in Congress. Congressional Democrats have so much hatred for the president and are so consumed by their own hysteria that it goes beyond any semblance of anything reasonable. On Saturday afternoon, maniacal gunmen shot and killed 22 people. You see, the number has gone up and may still go up. It's a terrible thing. Of all the times for this country to come together, now is that time. And the president went on the air and he urged the country to come together, to solve these problems together, and let's get this done. But that's not what happened. The president said that he will go to El Paso to visit the community where this happened. And that's absolutely appropriate for a president to do in the face of such a huge tragedy. But the Democrats don't want him to come. They're warning him not to come. Why? Because they are holding him responsible for the shooting. It's insane. He's not responsible for any of it. This guy had his own demons that were running around in his head, and the president had nothing to do with any of that. He's coming down to El Paso as President of the United States to pay his respects to the people who died and were wounded there and to their survivors. But immediately, it all became political. Veronica Escobar, who represents that district where the Walmart is, lashed out at him and held him responsible for the shootings on Saturday afternoon. She said, "The president has made my community and my people the enemy." Of course, she was talking on MSNBC's Morning Joe. Where else? "From my perspective," she said, "he's not welcome here. He should not come here while we are in mourning." Really? And then Democrat presidential hopeful Tim Ryan, Democrat of Ohio, urged the mayor of El Paso to quietly tell Trump that he isn't welcome in the city. And Bernie Sanders, he said, "I say to President Trump, please stop the racist anti-immigrant rhetoric. Stop the hatred in this country, which is creating the kind of violence that we see," unquote. Really? He's creating the hatred? You know, some of these Democrats should look in the mirror once in a while and get a real look at who is creating the divide and the hatred. You know, it wasn't a Republican who shot a Democrat on the baseball field. It was a follower of Bernie Sanders who shot Steve Scalise and put him in the hospital for a huge amount of time. And then former Vice President Joe Biden, Uncle Joe, he suggested that when Trump condemned white supremacy the morning after the shootings for the first time, he was wrong. It was a lie. It wasn't the first time, and it undoubtedly wouldn't be the last time. But it fit the narrative. Foul-mouthed Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke was equally blunt in his comments about the president. I can't even repeat on the radio what he said. You know, he said, "You know the blank," he's been saying. "He's been calling Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals. You know the answers to these questions. I mean, connect the dots about what he's been doing in this country. He's not tolerating racism. He's promoting racism. He's not tolerating violence. He's inciting racism and violence in this country." Unquote. Really? That was a pack of lies. And then there was foul-mouthed Senator Cory Booker after Trump's speech. And he said, quote, "Republicans need to get their blank together and stop pandering to the NRA. And Mayor Pete Buttigieg said, quote, "There's no question that white nationalism is condoned at the highest levels of our government. Right now, you see the rhetoric being echoed by the White House, and there is a measure of responsibility that you just can't get away from when you have case after case of racial rhetoric coming out of the White House," unquote. And it just goes on, and it gets worse. Kamala Harris, who said, quote, "He has emboldened white nationalism. He's given it power. He has elevated it. He has coddled it, and he has got to stop." She told that to MSNBC, of course, about Trump. And then Joe Biden, crazy Joe, he said, "Mr. President, immigration isn't the problem. White nationalism is the problem. America's inaction on gun safety legislation is the problem." And then after Trump's speech, he followed up on Twitter with a claim that hatred cannot be expelled from the White House until there is a new president. He said, "Let's be very clear. You use the office of the presidency to encourage and embolden white supremacy. You use words like infestation and invasion to talk about human beings." No, he didn't, as a matter of fact. He was talking about rats. "We won't truly speak with one voice," Biden said, "against hatred until your voice is no longer in the White House," unquote. And then there's Elizabeth Warren, who focused her message on the shootings in her pitch. "Donald Trump," she said, "says hate has no place in this country. Donald Trump has created plenty of space for hate. He is a racist. He has made one racist remark after another. He has put in place racist policies, and we've seen the consequences of it," unquote. Well, that's a huge pack of lies. But Senator Warren doesn't seem to have any problem lying. She lied about her minority status way back when she applied for a position at Harvard. She got it as a minority woman, which she is not. Do you see what's happening here? All of these comments, all these candidates, and I use the word loosely, I just can't imagine any of them sitting in the White House. All of them are fighting and clawing at each other, trying to be the worst, to have the worst possible accusations against the president, to be the strongest and the most aggressive opponent of President Trump. You know, frankly, none of them could hold a candle to President Trump. And I don't think a single one of them would make it on the stage with him. He'd tear them to ribbons. But they're going to be out there clawing their way to the top of the candidate pyramid. And we'll see what happens. But honestly, between you and me, it's pathetic. What has happened to the Democrat Party is beyond sad. And it's a reflection on our country. And we need to do something about it. We need to make this better. And the first way to do that is to start to mend our fences, to reach across the aisle and try to find some area of commonality where we can sit down and talk to each other and start solving some problems. And before we leave this topic, there's just one thing I would like to point out. It is so infuriating. The loss of dignity in this country is appalling. I mean, we could see it in the crass speech of our presidential candidates, the use of so many swear words, ugly swear words, vulgar swear words, in their common speech. We have slid right down into the slime of the swamp. And I think it's high time we got out and washed ourselves off. Look at what's happened just in the last few days. The pack of candidates who came down like a cloud of locusts and pounced on President Trump within 24 hours of the attacks of Saturday and Sunday was appalling. Within 24 hours of the events that took more than 30 lives. What is wrong with people? How do you politicize events like this before the bodies are even in the ground, while they're still warm, while the mourners haven't even buried their dead? These people are so consumed with their own selves that they have no thought for decency, for what is right, for what is appropriate. They have no respect for the suffering and the grief of others, and they disgrace us all. And these are the people who are fighting and clawing at each other because each one of them wants to be president of the United States. My gosh, what a spectacle. Okay, well, hopefully this will be a little bit of comic relief, and if it weren't so scary, it actually might be very funny. But California has done it again. Their last little bit was to give free health care to undocumented illegal immigrants when their own citizens, their own residents, don't get free health care. And more than that, the residents are paying through their taxes for the free health care for the illegal immigrants. How about that? My gosh, okay. The latest is a new initiative that was developed by the California school system. It's a proposed new California curriculum that has a course, a class, that's called Ethnic Studies. And it provides a handbook for classroom propagandizing. Got that? What do you think they want to teach your kids, if you live in California? They want to teach them that capitalism is racist. What? You heard me. Capitalism is racist. Here's an excerpt. Capitalism is described as a form of power and oppression, alongside patriarchy, racism, white supremacy, ableism. Capitalism and capitalists appear as villains several times in the document. The appearance of this new curriculum is really going to teach our kids a warm and fuzzy kind of communism. Not just socialism, communism. And the good news is that the state has put out a comments period, which is open until the 15th of August. So you don't have much time. If you want to make a comment about this to the state of California, go for it. Good luck with that. Well, it's been wonderful spending this hour with you once again, and I hope you'll come back. I'll be back again next week, same time, same station, as they used to say. And I look forward to seeing you here. You've been listening to News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this has been The Friedman Report.